Inside Charlottesville with Coy Barefoot starts right now. 284-9470. Taking your calls shortly.
Booster.
Go.
Retro.
Go.
Vital.
Go fly.
Guidance.
Guidance go.
Surgeon.
Go fly.
Ecom.
We're go fly.
GNC.
We're go.
Delmu.
Go.
Control.
Go fly.
Procedures.
Go.
Inco.
Go.
FAO.
We are go.
Network.
Go.
Recovery.
Go.
Capcom.
We're go fly.
Launch control. This is Houston. We are go for launch.
Go hard shot.
After 4 o'clock here in Charlottesville, Virginia, I'm Coy Barefoot. Good afternoon. We're broadcasting live from 94.7 FM right here in this little city I love. And I hope you're doing well. Happy Monday. Thank you for being with me. This is Inside Charlottesville. You can find the program online at InsideSeville.com. It's where all the podcasts and interviews live. We want to thank the sponsors of this program, the Young Men's and Boys Shop, the Men's and Boys Shop in downtown Charlottesville, Skyline Cleaners in the Barracks Road Shopping Center, the Therapy Hair Salon on West Main Street, all my great friends at ACAC, and the newest sponsor to the program. We'll have a lot more to tell you about that in the future, and that is Crazy Fast Internet, brought to you by Ting. Want to welcome them on board to the program. So here's how it's going to run today. We clearly have a lot to talk about. We have a lot to discuss. I will bring in the guys with the Monday Roundtable for an extended version today. Sean and Rick and Jackson will be here. We'll talk about the series of tragedies that took place. If you're a regular listener to this program, you know that every Monday afternoon we have been talking about this alt-right rally. As a matter of fact, news of the plans for that rally were actually broken in this market on this program when we first heard about them many weeks ago. And so we're going to talk about that. But before we do, I want to talk to Nicole Himmer, author, journalist. Her most recent book is Messengers of the Right. She writes for U.S. News World Report, Vox, and works at the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia. Nicole joins me live on the program. Nicole, thank you so much for taking some time out this afternoon. I know you are very busy, as are all of us in the media right now who have any connection whatsoever to do with Charlottesville. And I just want to thank you for making some time for this program. You were down there this weekend. Can you take a moment to share with us what you remember about what happened?
Sure. Well, when I arrived on the scene, probably a little bit after 11, so about an hour before the rally was supposed to start, it had already devolved into some pretty serious violence. The two sides were clashing. At the time, the barricades were still up, so they were throwing things at one another and tussling with one another across the barricades. The thing that surprised me most about that scene was that the police, while there, and certainly able to witness the violence that was happening, didn't intervene. And I'm not sure if that was their policy or why that choice was made. But that was kind of the leitmotif, if you will, of my experience of that day, was that as I watched some pretty violent scenes unfold across Charlottesville, the police were always nearby, but not necessarily intervening in what was happening. For me, perhaps the most violent scene before the car ramming attack took place outside of Market Street parking garage and then spilled into Market Street parking garage, where a set of white nationalists, probably five or six, set upon a young black man who's now been identified, but a 20-year-old black man who they beat with sticks both inside and outside of the parking garage, which was a pretty horrifying thing to witness.
And then how did you hear about the car running into the crowd? Actually, the car ran into the guy ran his car into the back of another car as two cars were moving through a parade of protesters. How did you hear about that event?
So I had left the scene of the rally / riot by about 1:10 or 1:15, and I'd actually gone down to the Whiskey Jar, which was one of the few places open on the downtown mall. And immediately after the attack happened, a woman ran into the restaurant, and it was pretty clear that something pretty bad had happened just from the way that she was crying. And so I simply hopped on Twitter, immediately saw what had happened, and then ran down to 4th Street.
And what did you see, Nicole?
So by that time, ambulances hadn't arrived yet. There were bodies everywhere. There was a lot of blood. There was the two crashed cars. Neither one of them had precipitated the incident, but there was a van in front and then a gray car behind it that had its entire rear end smashed. I talked to an eyewitness who said that was the car that had been hit, and that actually the people who had been most seriously hurt were caught between that car and the car that had rammed it. By that time, we were beginning to get medics on the scene, and so people were trying to protect the people who had been injured, both from the sun and from the cameras that were everywhere trying to take in the scene.
And just complete mayhem. And I remember reading, I did not go downtown during these events over the weekend. And we'll certainly be talking about why later in this program. But I was reading, of course, a lot of Twitter and watching live feeds. And I remember reading your comments online as you were out there. I remember you saying, I'm here. And I'm not going to put any pictures up, but it's just horrific. It's as bad as you think, but I can't put any pictures online.
It didn't seem right for me at that moment to be generating those pictures. It felt like those images were going to get out there eventually, but not being able to talk with the people who were injured, not wanting to interfere with the first responders who are on scene, and just... You know, it's an ethical question I think everyone needs to grapple with, which is what role do you play first as journalists in documenting what's happening, but also in disseminating that? I mean, I think that most people, having seen the images that came out of Nice and other places, know what it looks like and didn't necessarily need me as one of the people sharing those images at that point in time. I will say, you know, I'm typically an analyst as a writer. I come to journalism through scholarship and not through reporting. And so being on that scene and having to grapple with those images, I think for me it was best to not share those images because I, too, still needed to kind of process what I was seeing.
Yeah. So now it's a couple of days later. How do you make sense of, and I want to try to start pulling the camera back from the grim, mm-hmm. tragic details here. And I want to discuss with you some of the larger themes and connect some dots here. But how do you make sense of what took place in Charlottesville, in our neighborhood, our home, on Saturday?
Well, I think that one thing that's worth noting, and I think you've probably noted it on your show before, is that setting aside the car ramming attack, most of this was anticipated. It was understood that there was going to be this rally, that it was most likely going to have violence attendant with it. It seemed to me from my studies of both the alt-right locally and nationally that what they were looking for was media attention and confrontation. And they got both those things. And that's what they wanted, and I think most people understood when they were coming that that's what, I mean, I don't think we knew the extent of what it was going to look like, but it's unsurprising. And knowing Charlottesville as a place that is still grappling with its history of discrimination and racism and segregation and its presence, its present of those things as well, that also has, though, a strong progressive element, a strong Black Lives Matter element, has a lot of activists who are willing to confront overt racism. Those forces were going to come into conflict. Those forces live in Charlottesville every day, but they've been ratcheted up, particularly in the last year and a half or so. And I think that not only could we have expected what happened to a certain extent on Saturday, but I think we should, you know, be aware that it could happen again.
And we should underscore the fact, which I think is important to recognize, that this isn't new. You know, white supremacists taking to the streets and acting violently against others, especially people of color, that's nothing new, and sadly, that's nothing new in this country. But what is it about 2017? What is it about Charlottesville that we should be keeping in mind?
Well, I do think it is, in fact, that there are these factions that live in Charlottesville. That Charlottesville was a place of massive resistance where white supremacism was the order of the day. And there are still plenty of people in Charlottesville who hold to ideas of racism and white nationalism. Like, that's part both of Charlottesville's legacy, but also the people who live here today. And there's a white liberalism that works on promoting a certain type of diversity. And there are progressives who want more social change. And I think that, you know, there was a terrible Daily Progress editorial that pinned all of this on the actions of Wes Bellamy. I think that the decision to remove the statues is part of what Charlottesville and other southern towns are trying to grapple with in terms of their history and trying to move forward from a pretty racist history. And when you confront white supremacism, you get violence, because racism and white supremacism are violent ideologies that, when confronted, smack back. And so I think that history in Charlottesville is a really important part of this.
We're talking with Nicole Hemmer, scholar, author, journalist. She writes for Vox.com, U.S. News and World Report, and her most recent book is Messengers of the Right, Conservative Media, and the Transformation of American Politics. Nicole, I want to connect the historic dots. Take a moment to consider the alt-right and this tragic turn of events in Charlottesville over the last couple of days with the work that you have done, the historical research that you have done, which you and I have discussed before on my radio program and the TV program, looking at the very beginnings of the modern conservative quote-unquote movement and movement conservatism in the late 1950s, early 1960s. Connect the dots between that and what took place in 64 with Barry Goldwater and the John Birch Society, and the alt-right today.
Yeah, I think there are some important connections. And I'll start by saying that I think that there's a history of conservatism that is not deeply entrenched in racist ideas. But if you look at conservatism in the late 1950s, one of the things that people on the right had to do was reckon with their connections with arch segregationism and racism in the United States. And one example that pops to mind as we're thinking about these connections is that William F. Buckley Jr., who is often treated as the respectable conservative, in 1957 writes an editorial called Why the South Must Prevail. And his argument there is, even though in many places white Southerners are outnumbered, they are the superior race. And so they should be the ones in charge. And this was his defense of Jim Crow and the interference with black voting rights. And that's important for our discussion, because what happens over the next 10 or 15 years is that yes, there is among some conservatives a rejection of racism, and among others there is a cleaning up of the presentation of racism and a sort of encoding of racist ideas. And that history is important to understand because it suggests that, you know, racism doesn't get resolved just because overt racism drops out of the language surrounding conservatism and surrounding the right. Now, that said, there was a concerted effort among conservatives in the early 1960s to try to purge what they saw as fringe movements from the right, to push out the John Birch Society, which was considered too conspiratorial, to distance themselves from the Klan and the American Nazi Party and these other elements on the right that they didn't want to be associated with. Today, what we're seeing are sort of two interrelated things happening among conservatives. You have a group of conservatives who are very concerned about distancing themselves from the alt-right, who abhor a lot of the things that the alt-right stands for. And then you have an alt-right that embraces both white nationalism and strongly anti-woman ideas, and that is trying to clean itself up, to present itself in a slightly different way. You didn't see that at the Charlottesville rally, but when you see members of the alt-right wearing polo shirts and khakis, when you see Richard Spencer putting on a nice suit, that's about playing respectability politics, which is something Buckley was doing back in the 1960s.
And these guys who rallied in Charlottesville under the banner of the alt-right, they are the heirs, they are the direct heirs to the American Nazi Party and the John Birch Society from the early 1960s that Barry Goldwater and the GOP and William F. Buckley, they stiff-armed. They said, we do not welcome you into the party. We do not want you here. They never went away.
Right, they never went away. And to put it fairly bluntly, they understood that they had an opening when Donald Trump ran for president, both because of the rhetoric that Trump was using and because of the people he surrounded himself with, that he used language about Western civilization and walls and Mexicans being rapists and murderers and attacking people like Khazir Khan. And white nationalists saw that, and they understood it. And when they endorsed him and weren't condemned, they saw him as an ally. And that pattern has been repeated over and over again over the past 2 years, to the point where people like Jason Kessler and Richard Spencer feel quite comfortable with Donald Trump in the White House. And that has to be understood as part of the story.
And of course, you know, there's perhaps been, some might say too many, some might say not enough references to Hitler and Hitler's Germany over the last couple of days as we all try to make sense of what's happening. But certainly, this is what tyrants do when they play on the fears and the identity politics of citizens. And Hitler was certainly doing that in Berlin. And I think some of the comparisons with Berlin in the late 20s and the early 30s is quite apropos to what we're seeing with the alt-right.
Well, absolutely. I mean, one of the more interesting things, I think, about the Charlottesville rally is that, to a certain extent, the alt-right in 2016 was trying to find a path to respectability, and they're still doing that. But it is telling that neo-Nazi groups were invited to this rally, that representatives of those groups were invited to speak at this rally. And so Jason Kessler, Richard Spencer, and the members of the alt-right who gathered in Charlottesville saw themselves not only as aligned with neo-Nazis, but as perhaps a conduit for helping to make neo-Nazis more mainstream. And that's, even that calculation, whether they were correct or not, the fact that they were making that calculation in this current environment should worry people quite a lot.
That they were so open, their arms were spread wide to the worst among us.
Right. They made a calculation that instead of being discredited by attaching themselves to neo-Nazis, that they would be empowered by that. And that's what I mean about why we should be worried. That calculus, whether right or not, suggests something is deeply amiss here in the United States.
Yeah. Nicole, you had mentioned the police presence, and I have spoken with a lot of people who were down there this weekend, and I want to be able to talk about this issue without somebody thinking that we're pointing fingers.
Mm-hmm.
It's not about pointing fingers, and it's not about assigning blame, and I need to say that up front. That's not what this is about. This is trying to understand what happened with law enforcement because this could happen again. I mean, the news breaking today is that the alt-right has a number of rallies planned for other cities, and they've pledged to come back to Charlottesville repeatedly. So we could be looking at something like this again, and we need to understand why law enforcement did what it did. Our former chief of police, my great friend Tim Longo, was on CNN recently saying he was baffled at the reaction of law enforcement and the plan not to intervene in so many instances. You saw this. I have heard about this happening from so many eyewitnesses who said, Coy, ICE watched people of color being beaten in the streets of Charlottesville. I saw people screaming for help from the police. And if they were there, they didn't move or they were nowhere to be seen. How should we make sense of that particular thread in the story?
So that, I think, is the big question, because we know that the police, both here in Charlottesville and across the Commonwealth, were preparing for this day. They understood that violence was likely and that they had to have a plan. So I assume they had a plan, and I would love to hear more about what that plan was. I will say, as a citizen and as an observer watching this, and for me, the starkest moment wasn't even the gathering over at Emancipation Park, although the non-intervention there was baffling as well, but was what happened at the Market Street parking garage. I mean, the Market Street parking garage is right next to one of the police stations, and there were police officers right there on the same side of the street, just yards away from where a young black man was pretty severely beaten, and there wasn't intervention. And that was pretty shocking, and I think that someone needs to come forward and explain what was happening there, because it's certainly not clear to me why nothing happened. And so I think that needs to be understood, and I think it needs to be addressed quite clearly, especially given even the recent history in Charlottesville of police officers who have acted far too quickly against people of color who haven't actually offered any sort of provocation. And to help people make sense of, you know, when there are armed Nazis walking through the street beating fellow citizens, why there isn't any sort of action then. And I think that's something that has to be addressed.
You mentioned that these Nazis were armed. We certainly saw a lot of that in the video and the pictures. They were many of them were open carrying firearms. I certainly saw a lot of that when I was driving around that afternoon. Give us your perspective on the First Amendment and free speech. But those who take to public parks with guns and weapons under the protection of the freedom of speech, and it sort of clouds the whole thing, don't you think? That can we have free speech? Can we have that give and take of ideas when those who are speaking are armed, not only armed but threatening violence while they're speaking?
I mean, I think that this is the question that we have to grapple with, because first of all, in an already volatile situation like this, the presence of an open carry gun is a provocation. It certainly, as I was walking down, one of the first things that I saw were several people open carrying, and I certainly felt considerably less safe. And so you have to think about the right to assembly in that environment, because the gun itself can drive people away from being able to practice that right because of the threat. And I'm not sure how you get a free exchange of ideas when one side is armed and not only threatening violence, but actually engaged in violence. And there is a silencing effect of introducing weapons in those situations. And in fact, there is a silencing intent in having weapons in those situations. So, I mean, this is a broader conversation to have about open carry in general. One of the big arguments over the past few years has been that for African Americans in particular, the Second Amendment isn't an amendment they have the right to practice in the same way as white Americans. And if they don't have the same rights to freedom of speech and they don't have the same rights to freedom to carry weapons and these sorts of things, we have to ask how much we're actually defending the equal rights of all of our citizens. And I think that that's the bigger context here when we're talking about these rights, is that they're treated in debate as absolute rights or as equally applied rights, and they're clearly not. And that has to be part of our conversation about rights.
How would you like to see, not as a scholar or a historian or a journalist, but how would you like to see, as a citizen of Charlottesville, as a member of this community, how would you like to see the city or the county respond to future applications for rally permits by these people?
Well, I think that the groups that applied for these permits and that staged the rally, which very quickly turned into a riot here in downtown Charlottesville, were very clear in their intent not just to communicate, but to cause violence in this town, violence that they perpetrated the night before without a permit, and that the city didn't intervene at that point, when it feels like the spirit, if not the terms, of their permit were violated by the acts of violence they carried out the night before. I mean, it just seems that, I mean, by all means, freedom of assembly, but you have to do it in a way that keeps people safe. And when a group has already proven itself to be a legitimate threat and interested in being a violent threat to other Charlottesvillians, you've got to think about how they assemble, how you can protect other people while respecting their rights to assemble, and how we think about speech, because not everybody has to have a microphone in the middle of a public park, especially when they're preaching violence.
Right. The free speech rights, the free speech of these people is certainly not being hindered. They're heard from quite a bit. They've got websites. They write books. They get together for dinners and speeches. They're on YouTube. I mean, you can watch these things. And so one could argue that your ability to get out your word is not being hindered in the least. And again, the First Amendment says, you know, you have the right to, peaceably to assemble, not just to assemble, but the word peace is in the First Amendment, that you can't disrupt the public peace in the name of free speech. You can't scream fire in a crowded theater.
Well, precisely. I mean, those are two separate but related things, peaceable assembly, but also non-threatening speech. Right, we have limits on the kinds of threatening speech that people can use. And when your core ideology is about violence toward other people, then you've already kind of violated the spirit of that amendment. So
yeah,
it's something we're going to have to talk about.
And I was watching those live streams from Jackson Landers, who will be here in just a few minutes. He was live streaming from, he was standing with the alt-right guys up there. He was standing with them, which was a great perspective because you could hear them talking. You could watch them. And he was just standing there next to them, filming them and live streaming on his Facebook page all morning. And the vile stuff, and I'm not saying that the counter-protesters weren't yelling back. They were. But they're not the ones who went and applied for a permit to go into the park and do this whole thing. The vile stuff they were saying in the park, I of course I can't say any of that on the air, but you can just sort of fill in the blanks and imagine the really hateful speech it was, and the fact that they came with weapons and shields and went into the park and started screaming every racial slur they could think of. It absolutely gives you pause should they ever come back and want to come to this town again.
Well, and I think that it's also worth underscoring that their speech is backed up both by violence, and this is the conversation I think we need to have, which is it's also backed up by the non-enforcement of the laws they were breaking. That gives them a permissiveness that wouldn't otherwise be there. And I think that's an important context for that conversation.
Yeah. My colleague and great friend Siva Vaidyanathan at the University of Virginia has an op-ed in the New York Times, which I would urge everyone to read. Go to my Facebook page and you'll see the link. He really ends on that question. How do we respond? How should we respond to this? Understanding that, you know, as long as somebody's standing there with a gun, there's not free speech. You know, as long as they're threatening you while they're speaking, that's not free speech. How do we as a community, as a people, as Americans who really want to leave our ideals stronger for those who come after us, democracy, the institutions that support democracy, how do we respond to this greater threat now? I'm not talking about the threat of disturbing the peace. I'm talking about the greater threat that comes from this kind of organized hate, which, you know, these people deplore, they abhor, they despise democracy. They loathe the institutions that support a democracy. They don't like a free press. They don't like public education, even though they benefited from all of that. They certainly do not like elective government. They are fans of totalitarian rule. And you can study the history of the alt-right back to, you know, France post-World War II and watch that, connect the dots all the way back. They truly wanted, these people wanted Hitler to win. And they believed in the mission, they believed in that project, and they believed in that style of government. How do we respond as a people to this threat that is so well organized and obviously mobilized?
So I would do it by thinking about a different historical lineage. Rather than thinking about France and thinking about Nazis and thinking about World War II, let's think about a time in the United States when democracy was similarly under threat. I mean, think about the period in the 1950s and 1960s when white supremacists were doing everything that they could in order to uphold Jim Crow and uphold segregation, even against the courts and the law of the land, and the extreme violence that they went to in order to make that happen. So how were they ultimately undermined? They were undermined by people empowering people of color, or people of color organizing for themselves and winning their own power, their ability to vote, their ability to influence the national government. So they were influenced by social movements. They were defeated by education and growing consensus in the United States, a growing consensus that was forged by black activists in the United States who made it unacceptable to be segregationist and who won the support of the federal government in order to enforce the rights that they had been denied for well over a century. And so I think that at least part of the answer then to your question lay in supporting black activists and people of color today who are organizing to protect themselves and to protect their rights and to protect a vision of democracy that is inclusive and that goes back to core values of simply democracy, but of, you know, the right to representation, the right to vote. Things that people can do today, if they can go register people to vote, they can fight back against voter suppression, the same kinds of things that people were fighting against in the 1940s and 50s and 60s, and they can take seriously what it means to be a democratic citizen. And that means joining protests. That means protecting the right to vote. And it means protecting the equality of all citizens.
Nicole Himmer is a columnist for Vox.com. She also writes for U.S. News. She is the author of Messengers of the Right, Conservative Media, and the Transformation of American Politics. I cannot urge you strong enough to go get that book and read it. It is absolutely fascinating. She's an assistant professor at the University of Virginia's Miller Center, co-host of the Past Present podcast, and a terrific friend of this program. Nicole, thank you so much for all the work you do, and we look forward to talking again. Thank you.
Thank you.
It's about 22 minutes in front of the hour of 5 o'clock. I'm Coy Barefoot, and you're listening to Inside Charlottesville. Coming up in just a few minutes, we'll kick off an extended version of the Monday Roundtable. We'll talk with Sean Kenny, who is the former director of the Republican Party of Virginia and one of the first leading Republicans in Virginia who came out against Donald Trump and the alt-right. We'll also talk with Rick Sincere, the former chairman of the Libertarian Party of Virginia, and Democratic activist, science writer, Jackson Landers, who reported live from the events downtown this weekend. Stay with me. 18 minutes in front of 5 o'clock here on 94.7 FM. I'm Coy Barefoot, and you're listening to Inside Charlottesville. We're online at InsideCville.com. I hope you are well. It has been a sad and tragic series of days here in this little city that I love, with the protests, the rally, the counter-protests, and, of course, the death of the two state troopers, tragic death in a helicopter crash just west of town, and the terrorist attack that took place in downtown Charlottesville, and the very sad death of a young woman who was protesting against the alt-right crowd and Nazis who were here. The Monday Roundtable, we do it every Monday at 5 o'clock. We're starting a little bit early today. Jackson Landers is at a press conference as we speak. Sean Kenny is on the way. Rick Sincere is with us. He's the former chairman of the Libertarian Party of Virginia, reports online at ricksincere.com, and writes for Bearing Drift, Virginia's conservative voice. Jeff Leonard, the founder and director of WPVC, is also with us live in studio. Rick, did you go down there this weekend?
Are you kidding?
Yeah.
I had been telling people for weeks, avoid downtown on August 12th, and I took my own advice. Your advice, too. Non-confrontation would have been the proper thing to do. But I stayed home, and I followed events on social media.
Yeah. And Jeff, were you down there?
I was quarterbacking the coverage for the radio station, so I was in and out. But I got little kids, and I was a little bit scared about that place because I thought I knew what was coming, but I wasn't prepared emotionally for what happened.
Yeah, and I want to talk to Sean when he gets here, certainly, want to for months on this program, Rick, every Monday afternoon. Sean has been saying, stay away from downtown Charlottesville on Saturday, August 12th. It's going to be really dangerous. These guys are coming armed. They're coming to hurt you. They're not the KKK that are going to wave Confederate flags and then get back in their trucks and drive back to North Carolina. They are coming to incite some kind of conflict, fight, and they are absolutely coming to fight.
And you could see that, by the way, they were dressed and arrayed with non-lethal weapons, although some of them did have guns. It looked from the pictures like some of them had guns, which makes me wonder why they were not dispersed even earlier, because I understand that under Virginia law, even though we're an open carry state, if you are in an assembly and you have guns, it becomes an unlawful assembly immediately.
Really?
Yeah, that's my understanding of the law. If three or more people are gathered, they can't be open carrying.
So I want to ask Jeff this because he knows these guys well, having served with them, but. There's a lot of threads to this whole story, and one of the threads is the reaction of the police this weekend. And I've talked with people who literally were standing there saying, we were screaming for the police to come help, and they just looked at us. They wouldn't go off their post. So clearly there were instructions. There was some kind of plan. Orders is the right word. Don't intervene. Don't intervene too much, maybe.
I suspect that's what's being discussed at the press conference with the chief of police right now, and I defer to Jackson when he gets here to talk about it, because I was not a witness to any of that, so yeah. I can't address it.
Jeff, you know this.
Those decisions were not made on an individual officer basis. I mean, those guys and ladies they go to an academy for at least 6 months, and they have 6 months in a car seeing somebody next to somebody. They are trained that when they see a crime take place in their presence, they act, and that is what they do, and they didn't do it this weekend on Saturday, and I don't think it was an individual officer that had to come down from somewhere else. And I think when the autopsy on this is done, someone is going to have some explaining to do about why, when felonies were being committed, when members of the legitimately the Nazi Party of America were walking down the street with clubs, hitting members of our clergy in the back and in the head, and pushing people to the ground, that they were allowed to do that with impunity. And the only people that came at that point to the rescue was either Antifa or the paramilitary militiamen from Kentucky and from New York, the guys walking around with M16s that weren't law enforcement. They appeared to be the ones that were sort of dispersing these three-on-one and four-on-one conflicts. It's going to take us years to sort out what happened this weekend.
Do you think the people of Charlottesville are rightly upset and angry at the... I mean, where do you look for this? The chief of police? The head of the state police? I mean...
In situations like this, there's a joint command center. I mean, there's the Charlottesville police. There's the Virginia State Police. There is the National Guard. There's the director of public safety. Ultimately, if you go up the chain of command, it lands on the desk of the governor, because they're all executive branch employees to some degree or another.
Right.
So I would, if given the opportunity, I would love to talk to Governor McAuliffe about what was going on.
Yeah.
I mean,
but people in Charlottesville are going to be mad at the chief of police, right? And maybe they should be. In the literature that went out to these guys before this event, it specifically said, please come to Charlottesville. We have been given assurances that we can act with impunity. Now, this may have been a total lie, but it's interesting to point out that that's exactly what happened. In the literature, in the advertisements that went out to these crazies, it said, you can come to Charlottesville. We've been told police will be standing down, and that we will be able to move throughout the city and act like we're doing whatever we want to do. And you know what? On Friday night and on Saturday, that's exactly what they did. That event broke up, and they dispersed into a whole bunch of little squads. They went throughout the city, beating up on people.
I think...
There were four arrests?
I think...
Total?
I think Friday night at University of Virginia surprised them. I think they were completely surprised.
Who's they?
The law enforcement.
Law enforcement.
And the city of Charlottesville. Be it law enforcement, city council, city government, state government. They were surprised.
I was. I didn't expect that many people.
Yeah,
I know Sean did, but and I can't wait till he gets here, because he's been saying all along, it's going to be huge.
It wasn't on the schedule. I mean, it came. I saw it online as it was happening. But
yeah, the Friday night torch-lit parade at UVA.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Where they were beating people.
Well,
members of the faculty,
with torches.
Students.
Yeah. And but there was that image of the white nationalist, the protester, whoever he was, macing a UVA student. I mean, right after they walked through with their torches. So clearly, if their intent was to be nonviolent, that lasted about 20 minutes, because they came to fight. And imagine if you're the UVA police department, and I've got friends on that department also. The college kids aren't here. This is a low time for them. I mean, I doubt they were on high alert.
And Most of them aren't back yet, right. Yeah.
So it's, UVA is a bit of an empty shell when students aren't here. They're getting ready for the students to come back. I don't know how many officers they had on duty that evening, but they had a call. I mean, I imagine that over here at the Hyatt, where the state police were staying, I imagine a call went out to get those guys out of bed and get them dressed and get over there as quick as possible, because I think this stunned those guys.
Yeah, it was totally... I'm wondering whether the police decision to stand down wasn't in response to accusations that they overreacted on July 8th when the KKK was here.
Yeah.
And, when they tear gassed the crowd. And I think they showed an overabundance of caution this weekend that was completely misplaced.
But they shouldn't be having to search for a sweet spot, right? I mean, what's wrong with just doing your job? That's what I don't understand. If you see somebody being beaten, why?
Yeah, I
don't understand why there would be some directive that would prevent a police officer from stepping in. But that's what happened.
Yeah, it might have been too dangerous for him. It might have
you
been.
Think?
The closest I've ever come to a full-on riot until Saturday when I was in and out of there was the Kentucky Derby. I mean, the infield of the Kentucky Derby is. Not quite as bad as Saturday, but it's awful. And the police officers, they move 20 to a pack. They have a person in charge, and they don't move. If one person moves, 20 of them move. And they form a skirmish line, because someone has to make an arrest. They've got to keep everybody else at bay while that arrest is effected. So if the police had engaged, it would have been dangerous for them.
Yeah.
So
I don't understand why, boy, 4th Street wasn't closed off. I mean, and maybe at one point in the day it was. I don't know. But I just don't understand how that guy could have raced across. And for those who are listening from outside the area, you know, the guy, the terrorist who ran his car into the crowd of people and into two cars who were in front of him. It was people and two cars. He went south across the downtown mall, 90 degrees to the mall, which is a pedestrian mall. But there are two roads that cross the mall, and this was the southbound road, 4th Street. He raced down that at full speed into the crowd and then reversed back across the mall all the way up to Market Street. He was apprehended shortly thereafter on Monticello Avenue, which is just a few blocks from there.
And the amazing thing that he was able to drive that far, given the damage to his car.
Yeah, because the video, one of those videos, captures that the whole front of his car was falling off.
What you're going to hear in the event in after the impact.
Here comes Jackson.
And what you're going to hear is, had that guy stopped there and gotten out of his car after he committed that terrorist act, he would have been killed. He would have been pummeled. So his attorney, whoever that may or may not be, is, I'm sure that's what their position is going to be. I'm not giving any legal advice, but if that guy obviously panicked and had he gotten out of that car, I think he would have been made.
So you're saying his lawyer will say, well, he had to race away.
Yeah. What else? What he was going to do? Had he gotten out, they were attacking him with bats. So that's what I'm not defending him. I'm saying,
of course not. Of course not. I know you're not. Yeah.
That's where this is going.
And his attorney is what's his name?
I think Buddy Weber got appointed for
right.
him. Who is interesting because Weber. Hi, Jackson.
Hey, so guys.
Jackson Landers has just joined us, and
Chief Al Thomas's press conference started like 25 minutes late. So I'm so sorry. I had to be there, and I rushed as fast as I could.
Yeah. So this is Charlottesville Chief of Police Al Thomas, who replaced Tim Longo, who stepped down last year.
That's right.
Who is Tim? Of course, great friends to all of us. Has a terrific national reputation. And Tim Longo, former Chief Longo, was on CNN recently saying he was baffled at how police handled this. And
I'm baffled.
Essentially saying, I wouldn't have done it like this. But, you know, what did you learn at the press conference this afternoon? You're coming just from that event.
Yeah, I'm coming just from that event. Well, there's some very interesting things. I mean, he said the sort of things you would expect, expressing, you know, shock and just sadness at the loss of three Virginians who died Saturday, including the two state troopers who were on the helicopter. But then, you know, there was the questions were a little bit interesting. So in some cases, maybe more than the answer. My question for him was why it was that, you know, I witnessed and I talked to other people who did as well. The theme all day long for me on Saturday, I was in the thick of it. All day long at every site that came up all day. Why is it that we witnessed dozens of people on both sides being violently physically assaulted again and again, with state and Charlottesville police officers standing by watching and doing absolutely nothing to help victims? I mean, I'm watching people being assaulted and cops are standing there doing nothing, not making arrests, not helping people, not giving aid, not calling in
EMTs. And people are screaming for their
help. People are screaming all day long. Everywhere I went, people said, where are the police? Well, they were everywhere. And they were nowhere. There were, you know, there was something like 1,000 of them. You'd go around a corner, there'd be 20 here and 40 there. And around the park, they were everywhere. Except, you know, when somebody was being attacked, they didn't come in and do anything. They watched. I watched people beaten bloody in the streets. And you can talk to many people who were there that day. Now, you're talking about somebody who sat in their, you know, business in the downtown mall or who was a few blocks back. They'll tell you, hey, the police did a great job. Yeah, because you weren't there watching. And I have heard this from some business owners who applauded the state police as they walked by because they weren't in the thick of it.
And their windows weren't broken.
And that's great. Don't get me wrong. I'm glad. I'm glad that's the case. But people were broken. I watched it happen all day long, and the police stood and did nothing. I don't think police officers are really like that. You don't become a police officer because you want.
That's what Jeff was just saying. They're not trained to do that.
There's no way. That's not who they are.
Instinctively, we can assume they want to help.
So my question to Chief Thomas, I said, did you give an order for them to stand by in these situations? And he'd give a one word answer: no. Well, okay, that may be true. Did someone else give them the... There's a lot of investigation I have to do in this. And then there was another question another reporter next to me asked, and I can't tell you what his sources are. This is somebody from out of town. He didn't recognize this particular journalist. But he said he had a he had met with he had a source, some law enforcement officer from a neighboring county who had... Oh, I have a recording. I haven't been able to listen to it. This officer had been brought in, you know, as, you know, a lot of people from surrounding areas as, you know, a supplement to force. And he'd been given a briefing on I think maybe Friday, about what to do. And this law enforcement officer apparently told this journalist, he said, they were instructed not to make any arrests without the approval of the mayor. I don't know if that's true. That sounds really weird. And Chief Thomas denied it, but he said there was a briefing, you know, in the city where they were told, do not make an arrest.
I find that really hard to believe.
On the other hand, only three people got arrested all day. That seems kind of weird. I don't know why.
Yeah, I thought it was four.
Four including, that's right, yeah. But so that sounds weird. I don't know if this guy has, if maybe somebody's just making things
legally
up.
I don't even think that makes sense.
Well, it doesn't make sense that they didn't make arrests when people were being assaulted.
And I was pointing out earlier in the conversation before you got here that the literature promoting this event to all the crazies told them specifically, it's in the writing. It says, in Charlottesville, we've been assured the police will stand down. And that you know, we're not going to have a problem with law enforcement. And whether they were lying, whether that was because they lie, we know that. Whether that was true or not, that is, in fact, what happened.
Well, I didn't see I don't want to portray that as a bias. I did not see any bias by the police on the whole, with one exception. I didn't see a bias, you know, in favor of the white supremacist or of the protesters. The only exception is, you know, after, you know, a day and an evening of watching everybody else just, you know, having to get attacked and the police do nothing. Then at that press conference yesterday at 2 o'clock, Jason Kessler got a personal army.
And they protected him.
Yeah, nobody else got protection, but he did.
And they arrested somebody who spit on him.
Yeah, did they?
So one of the moments of in some of this, there was some levity. And Jackson and I were sitting next to a gentleman yesterday at the press conference. And this guy was determined to go up there and either punch Kessler or attack him or disrupt it somehow. And Jackson and I are talking to him, saying, you know, and he didn't get his opportunity. He wasn't first in line. So he was going up there, and he just didn't get there first.
What's the proper response? Really quick, and then we'll break. And we'll talk about all of this. We've got another hour of the program today, so we'll certainly have a lot more to discuss, and Sean Kenny is on the way. But what's the proper response, Rick, to Jason Kessler, to the guy in this community who helped to organize this whole event and is part of this troop, squad, gang, whatever you want to call them, who believes that their event was a complete success and that that woman deserved to die? That's what they've said. That's what says in their literature, a Daily Stormer. It says, you know, and I'm not going to say what they said, but they celebrate the event, great success, we're definitely coming back, and, oh, well, the woman who died, you know, it was a good thing she died.
Well, yeah, and actually, Chris Cantwell, who Jackson aided...
I'll tell you a story about him later.
Yeah. But he specifically said, you can judge our success by the number of people in the morgue and in the hospitals, which is, you know, just frightening. But as far as Kessler's concerned, you could read his face at that press conference yesterday that he was completely overwhelmed.
Overwhelmed with joy or with fright.
He was scared for his life, and he should have been. I mean, if you look at the video of that press conference, at least three people physically assaulted him. I saw him get punched by two people, and he got tackled by another person, none of whom have been arrested. And then there was the guy who spit at him who was arrested, which, again, it's weird police behavior. You know, they witnessed. I mean, the police were there when he was punched in the face, and the guy who punched him in the face apparently was able to walk free, which may be what a lot of people would like to be the case.
Right.
You know, the police are supposed to be equal opportunity protectors.
You don't think the arrests are over. So the arrests are coming. People are identifying individuals. People are going to the magistrate. They're filing warrants. I believe more arrests will be coming.
You're listening to the Monday Roundtable on Inside Charlottesville. I'm Coy Barefoot. We've got another full hour coming up discussing the tragic and perplexing events here in the city of Charlottesville over the weekend. Stay with us.
But the fight's not over. It's in your hands. Stand up. say no. And there are communities across this country who will say no with you. And even if we fail, it doesn't matter. I don't fight fascists because I'm going to win. I fight fascists because they're fascists. Thank you.
It's about 8 minutes after 5 o'clock here in Charlottesville, Virginia. I'm Coy Barefoot. Welcome to Inside Charlottesville. We're online at InsideSeville.com. And you can find me online at CoyBarefoot.com, Facebook and Twitter as well under that name. I'm glad you're here. We've got a lot to talk about today. I want to thank the sponsors of this program, ACAC, the Therapy Hair Salon and Spa on West Main Street, Skyline Cleaners in the North Wing of the Barracks Road Shopping Center, the Men's and Boys Shop, Ragged Mountain Running Shop, and of course, our newest sponsor, Crazy Fast Internet. It's Ting, right here in Charlottesville. The Monday Roundtable, we do it every Monday from 5 to 6. We started a little bit early today. Sean Kenny is with us, the former director of the Republican Party of Virginia. Rick Sincere, the former director of the Libertarian Party of Virginia. Democratic activist, journalist, science writer Jackson Landers as well.
Former Democratic activist. I'm a journalist now. I can't do both.
That's important to note that. Yes, indeed. And they're all with us live in studio for a conversation about what took place here in Charlottesville over the weekend, the tragic turn of events with the Unite the Right rally on Saturday, news of which I believe was broken on this program, at least in Charlottesville, where we first discussed this many weeks ago, that this was going to come up in August. We have talked about it every Monday for months about what we could expect. And Sean, I want to go to you first, your thoughts about what happened. And I told you before we went on the air, you know, as I'm watching Jackson's live stream on his Facebook page on Saturday morning, as he's standing out there with those guys in the park, I thought about you over and over again. And I could picture you sitting where you're sitting right now on this program every Monday, as we sit here every Monday over the last few months. And you have said repeatedly, please be careful. These guys are dangerous. They are coming to town. In August, they will be armed. Their whole MO is to attack people, is to instigate riots, is to instigate conflict. They are coming to hurt you. That is why they are coming here. They are coming to push your buttons so that you will get so riled up. And if you don't hit them first, they're going to hit you first. And you had said this repeatedly every Monday. So no, I wasn't shocked. I wasn't even surprised that someone died, I'll be honest, because I've been listening to you talk about what these guys do. I'm saddened, and it's tragic, and it's horrible that someone died in our town on Saturday. And I've shed my share of tears over this horrific, horrific series of events. What was going through your mind this weekend?
So the Daily Stormer, who's perhaps in the neo-Nazi side out there, said that they measured the success of yesterday by bodies in the hospital and bodies in the morgue. That was their measure of success. I had, you know, there was a gentleman, there's an old friend of mine from Fredericksburg who's mostly on the left, actually all the way on the left. It's Arch DePepe. He's a great human being, very passionate. But, you know, he and a number of others have kind of clapped me on the back saying, you know, it's like, well, Sean, you know, we're really proud of you for kind of, you know, pointing this out early and bucking the line and kind of rallying Republicans. I had to tell him point blank. It's like, look, I don't...
Rallying Republicans to...
To fight the alt-right, obviously. Yeah. I mean, so it's like, or just rallying, it's like, this is, I mean, but he pretty much is like, yeah, we're proud of you for what you've done. And, you know, I told him, it's like, you know, the pride is like the last thing I feel right now. I mean, resolved, angry, hurt, confused, defeated to a certain point, Goy. I mean, you beat the drum on this so hard. It's like, take these guys seriously. You know, they're not just the Ku Klux Klan sitting on the front porch drinking a six-pack, raging against the black man. You know, these guys are out to hurt people. If you throw a brick, they're going to throw a car. You bring a stick, they're going to bring a gun. And that's exactly what they did. I mean, in one dead, 19 wounded in one incident, I saw numbers that was as high as 35 wounded.
Yeah, I saw that number, too.
In this event. You know, and
because it's 19 at that event with the car ran, but there were people who were beaten elsewhere.
Oh, that number is off. It's 35. They said that were, you know, EMS went out and
total.
Treated. But I know I talked to an EMT who told me, I'm not going to use his name, but we weren't officially on the record. You know, he said that there were people who couldn't get through, who couldn't get ambulances. People were walking or being driven to hospitals, you know, in and out of the area. So it was way more than 35.
So we don't know what the body count was.
We have no idea.
So here's where, I mean, and it could have been a lot worse. I mean, that guy was stopped by a car. Car, for crying out loud. I mean, we were talking before we went on the air. I mean, if that car was not there, he would have plowed into many, many more. He could have taken a right turn. The bodies would have piled up in front of his car. He would have thrown it in reverse. It is exactly what you just saw when he was getting out of Dodge, coming backwards.
Yeah.
That's terrifying to me. You know, I think terrorism is the appropriate word for something like that. You kind of say, it's like, I wish more people had listened. No, I mean, it's too late for that. You know, we're now at a point where we have two sides in Charlottesville, in America writ large, that are done talking to one another. And frankly, that scares me. I think for the, you know, people will use this as hyperbole. I'm choosing not to do this. I think for the very first time in a long time, I am genuinely afraid for the future of this country. Because I don't see many of our political leaders. I see them, you know, we'll tie a ribbon on and we'll decry the violence.
We'll point fingers very quickly.
Or we'll point fingers and take political advantage, which is exactly what people have started doing.
Yep, immediately.
I don't see the conversation that needs to be held as to how we can wind this back. And that, to me, I will point the finger at Trump. When the leader of the free world, putatively, cannot bring himself to identify evil for what it is, and it takes him 48 hours to do so, as an afterthought, that's a problem. And that really rocked me on my heels. I can't say it in any other way.
Yeah. Where's the leadership? Where was the police? We'll certainly continue that thread. Where was the police? But where is the leadership? And... you know, you can tell people, hey, don't go down there. It's going to be really dangerous. It's scary. These guys want to hurt you. But there's this sense of moral obligation. No, I have to be there. I mean, that certainly animated that young woman who was killed. You can look at her Facebook page to hear from her friends. She was all about that moral responsibility to go up and stand up against it and let these crazy people, anti-American, anti-democracy people, know, you know, I do not support you. You are not welcome here. And we can applaud her for that, but she's dead. And it's like I told my daughter this weekend. She was brought to near tears about this. She's 15. And I said, you know, I want you to be, I'm going to cry thinking of her, but I told her, I want you to be the kind of person that would go out and stand up against this kind of stuff. But I also want you to be alive, and I don't want you to put yourself in a position where you could be killed. And, you know, you think about those people who were, they were just turning the corner off of Water Street, walking up to the mall. That's where they were.
I walked down that street probably three times every day.
Yeah, that's my point. It's like if you could, of all places where you would feel safe, Water Street in downtown Charlottesville, Virginia, on a beautiful Saturday afternoon, surrounded by friends and neighbors, like-minded friends and neighbors, and you're out doing the right thing, and you were killed for it. It's just, for all of us I know, and I know everybody listening to me, it's just beyond heartbreaking.
But just getting back to doing the right thing, taking off on what Sean was saying about this so-called president, any other head of state in the United States in the past 100 years, going back to Warren Harding, would have instinctively known how to say Nazis are bad, racism is bad,
right.
We cannot tolerate this kind of activity, these ideas are pernicious. No other president would have had to wait 48 hours to be handed a piece of paper with the words on it to read that. They would have known how to say it without anybody telling them to say it.
Well, Tom Perriello hit the nail on the head with his tweet shortly thereafter.
He was there, by the way. I saw him at the protest.
At the protest, yes.
Yeah, he was on the ground. I've seen pictures. There.
Former gubernatorial candidate, Democratic congressman from Virginia, former congressman Tom Perriello, tweeted on Saturday. It's like, you know, I can't remember the exact words, but he basically said, you know, isn't it time to accept the fact that that the president didn't just screw up the words? He's a white supremacist. I mean, what other proof do you need? And we heard that from so many people. Certainly Wes Bellamy, agree or disagree with his politics, but I certainly agree with him when he said in the national media, what other proof do you need, as you're saying, that this country's in a bad place, that people of color are in danger, that people who stand up to this kind of hatred are in danger? Because as Sean said, they want to kill you. They want to kill you for standing up to fascism. They don't like democracy. They like Putin. They like Trump. They want to, although, you know, that's debatable, the extent to which they like Trump. But they don't like democracy. They don't like a free press. They don't like journalists. They like authoritarian rule. They like totalitarianism. It's a stronger, more nimble force that they want to be a part of. And they want to hurt people who don't agree with them.
And the weird thing is, these people who support totalitarianism and autocracy put it in words to say, we need this for our liberty. They completely pervert the idea of individual liberty by saying, we can't be free unless we are slaves. It makes no sense. It's
Orwellian.
It's Orwellian, exactly.
So guys, I actually...
It's the Tories from the 18th century who looked at the revolutionaries and said, we're plenty free under the king. What are you talking about? You know, this is great. We're part of the strongest empire in the history of the planet, England. I love my king. I'm free. What are you talking about, Thomas Jefferson? You know, sit down and shut up.
So I have not consumed any media since Friday. I haven't seen any coverage of this.
But you've been creating a lot of it.
That's all I've been doing. Last couple nights I've slept maybe 3 or 4 hours, and all I've been doing is being on this story, on the ground, everywhere. And then when I sit down and open my laptop, it's to write and file a story. So I have no idea what's going on in the world. I don't know if we're at nuclear war with North Korea. So how would you...
Alt-Right says they're planning at least 9 other rallies in 9 other cities next
week. I'm deep down in this. This is all I've been consumed with. I mean, personally, on the ground, everywhere I can be. But what's the temperature on this? What is America looking at this and saying, if you could sum it up like in a sentence or so?
I think on the left, it's horror. I think on the right... it is an admixture of sheepishness from those who really didn't expect this to be real, or pointing back at the anti-fascists and saying, well, why are we expected to condemn Nazi flags, but the Democrats are expected to condemn communist flags? And so the equivocation card gets played. And as we start getting into Wednesday, Thursday, you know, they'll rally and figure out what their narrative is on Breitbart and other sites like that. I think it's still...
In the near term, they're celebrating the event.
I mean, yeah, the alt-right spike in the football.
Like,
I mean,
she deserved to die, and what a great event, and this was success, and we're going to repeat this all over the place.
The Virginia Flaggers are going to do a rally in Richmond on the 16th of September.
Oh, my God.
So here we go again. Now, this is the one I was picking on the alt-right. It's like, okay, you'll come to Charlottesville and you do this nonsense, but you won't go to downtown Richmond. Will you? Because you know what'll happen if you go to downtown Richmond. Now they're coming to downtown Richmond, so we'll see what that turns into.
And just to get back to your original point, it does absolutely this where we've gotten it. It
brings to fruition what the alt-right is all about.
Of course, this is
what they want. This is what Bannon wants. Mm-hmm. He wants to burn it all down. He wants fighting in the streets, unrest in the streets. He wants people to lose all their faith
in the institutions that support democracy,
yeah. like police and your government and public schools and journalism. All those things that the founders risked their lives to create so that we would ensure the long-term viability of a democracy that could grow and change and increase and protect the rights of others and set the example for the world. These guys hate that crap.
Yeah,
they hate it.
And it's to Jackson's point. I mean, it's. I think both sides are trying to craft their narratives at the moment. I mean, most of it's just been straight up reporting and here are the facts, ma'am. But both sides are spinning their narratives, and at least that's the way I'm seeing it from the outside looking in. Mm.
So, what was your when you're standing down there, Jackson, in the park on Saturday morning? And I watched every minute of it, and. Talk about those guys you were standing with, because you weren't standing with the other reporters safely removed from the distance. You were standing literally right next to the worst of the worst out there.
The most dangerous place in Charlottesville physically to be at that moment. I was reporting on the Civil Weekly locally, working with a team of reporters and also writing for Rewire.news. I have a feature that just went up on Rewire. You can go take a look at it. It's a whole narrative of telling kind of my story. I've also been doing short pieces, procedural pieces for the Daily Beast on it. But as part of the team with the Civil Weekly, you know, one person cannot tell this whole story of an event like that. And we knew that going into it, that one person can't be in one place. There's just too much happening. And so we decided to, working with Lisa Province and some other reporters, we decided to spread out. And I guess I'm the only man on the reporter team. And Eze Amos is a male photographer, of course. I was the only. So they like, Jackson, well, you're a white dude. Let's put you on alt-right duty. So we want you to get as close to the alt-right.
So for those who didn't see your video in your live stream, explain these guys.
So you got to understand, this is a...
What were they doing? What were they like?
There were so many different... some of them are wearing basically like uniforms that are supposed to look pretty much like a black version of a Nazi. There were some of them trying to dress like SS officers. Some of them look like rednecks. Some of them look like Richard Spencer. Some of them look like,
And when you say Richard Spencer, you mean like khakis and a polo.
That's right, yeah. Some of them were dressed like, like almost like a Hell's Angels wannabe. There are a lot of different... Some of them have American flags. Some of them have Nazi flags. Some of them have swastika tattoos. It's such a... And then some of them just look like anybody else you might see and smile and hold the door for. There's lots of different types of people, and they all have, some of them have different beliefs. Some of them were behaving in a way that was just like sociopathic, like Eze Amos, who is Nigerian. He was born in Nigeria, and he's, married an American, and he's, a dark-skinned black man. He was, before the things even really got going, he got punched in the face just for existing.
He's a photojournalist.
He's a photojournalist. He's a very good photojournalist. His photos are amazing. I think he deserves a Pulitzer for what he did on Saturday. So some of them would just go up and do that. And then some of them were actually genuinely nice, just advise, helpfully say, like the guy who said, watch out for the piss bottles. What? Yeah, they're throwing bottles of piss at us, that, Antifa protesters were. Or people actually, one guy just offered me some water, and these were so. There's, and then some of them were just straight up sociopaths. There's a whole range of different types of personality, and some of them had homemade body armor, and some of them had professional body armor. There were a few times I thought, oh wow, there's an actual police officer in here where the conflict is, and realized no, it's an alt-right guy. I did not see any alt-right with firearms. The guys with firearms were all militia members who were actually they're not white supremacists. They're opposed to those guys. And
the guys that look like National Guard?
Yeah, the guys who look like Taliban-esque National Guard. I mean, because they have like scraggly beards. Yeah, when I had the opportunity to chat with their leader, and it's not something I would do, but he made a reasonable case. He said, then it's not they expect to shoot anybody. It's that their physical presence means something to the alt-right. They're a little bit afraid of those guys. They're afraid of the militia guys, and they respect them, and they thought that just the sight of them there would mean something. And I didn't see, and I have to say, there's no group on either side this event that I can say you know, your behavior was exemplary, and I didn't see any of you doing it. There's no group I can excuse and say you were all perfectly behaved, except those militia guys. That's not something I expected. I mean, there are groups of people who I would expect to say would have been peaceful protesters,
yeah,
who were throwing things. So the center of the battle, and what did become like a battle. So these guys have shields. Again, they didn't have guns, but they had shields. They had sticks and staffs and things to fight with. And as things got intense, you had these more groups of the alt-right that had to file through the protesters, and come through them. And what started happening is these guys would come up the stairs. So the focus of the battle was the stairs into Emancipation Park. And I was at the top of the stairs, like next to that bush. And so these guys would come up, and I started seeing these, before I got real, a couple of bottles were thrown around, but, I started seeing lines of these guys coming up, on obviously in physical distress, people who had been, I could see they'd been beaten, people who were bruised and
these were the alt-right guys.
These were alt-right guys who had come through the crowd. They had been, you know, some of them were, they had been, you know, pepper sprayed or maced or all kinds of, you know, there was tear gas that was being deployed by the protesters, not by the police as far as I know. The police have denied using, Chief Thomas denied that the police used any tear gas, so all the tear gas was brought by, you know, civilians.
Counter protesters.
Yeah, I think all the tear gas I saw came from. We'll get to that. So these guys were coming in. Obviously, they'd been assaulted. You know, some of them, their eyes are in pain. They're having trouble breathing, and so they had been assaulted. They were being attacked as they came into the park. And you know, I'm not defending who they are or what they're doing, but they were there, and they were, you know, you had protesters attacking them first, as far as I could tell. And in fact, in one of them, this guy, this big burly tough guy with a bunch of tattoos, he stumbles into the park, he's screaming in agony, he falls down at my feet, and he's got something on his face, he's like yelling to get it off. And I just, you know, I don't know who he is, but it's just as a human being who's in pain. And so I had a bottle of water, and I crouched down and I opened up the water, and I'm giving him water to wash whatever it is off his face. And in fact, there was another guy saw me helping him crouch down. He's trying to help, and he says, "Here, hold my flag." I said, "I can't hold your flag, but I can give him water." I mean, literally, I'm a journalist. I cannot hold your white supremacist flag. And I helped, you know, kind of administer first aid to this guy who turned out to be Chris Cantwell, who the irony is, and he, I would help him again. He was somebody who was suffering. He needed help. But the irony is, supposedly he pepper sprayed, protesters at the UVA torchlight vigil the night before at UVA. This had been done to him, and it was visited back on him. And he's made comments saying that chemical weapons should be used, against liberals. But so I did, I saw this, and it's just constant. And there's people milling around, and you would have a rain of missiles. By missiles, I just mean stuff being thrown, which at first was like empty water bottles and turned into other things. I did not get hit by any urine. Other people did. And then bigger stuff. Apparently some people said they were like rocks and bricks. I couldn't identify every object that was coming in. And we would have these hails of objects that I had to duck. And when it would get heavy, they'd call shields, shields. And you would have guys with shields would run up, and it was like something out of like a, you know, Robin Hood movie or something. They all put their shields up as if the arrows are coming in, and they, you know, provided a wall for things to come down. And they were chanting things that the things they were chanting on. I mean, I can't repeat here. Horribly racist, anti-Semitic things. You know, and the funny thing, some it's the same people who would chant these like hateful things using the N-word. You know, one of these guys, then he was saying in a bullhorn 15 minutes later, "I don't see it. The hate is all over." And I'm paraphrasing. "The hate is on your side. I don't see any hate over here." What? You've just been chanting this, and you've got a swastika. And, you know, what do you, you know, what?
But that is part of the mindset, isn't it, Rick?
Yeah.
That they believe that the fascism, the organized hate, the real threat of violence against them is coming from liberals.
But I understand what. So I think I may have a unique perspective, having stood on the steps watching these people for, I don't know, an hour and a half or whatever it was. I know I wasn't the whole hour and a half up long. I probably a good hour on the stairs. And literally seeing the world from their perspective. I mean, in this battle, yeah, they're standing there and they're thinking these people are throwing stuff at it. They're thinking they're spraying our guys. We have this message for how we're going to make the world, you know, better for our friends and family. And these people are attacking us. And so from their perspective, they feel like heroes. Shields, shields. You come in and you're defending, and they feel righteous about what they're doing. So I understand, I think, why they feel that way. When they come out of this situation, they feel like we went to battle and we were attacked. by that angry mob below, and we have endured. And I think that's why they feel that way, especially because now they committed acts of violence. Also, I did witness. In fact, at one point, I saw when they were throwing bottles. It wasn't bricks at that point. You know, there was a member of the alt-right, a tall young man. He said, "I'm going to find a rock," and he was reaching around under the bushes looking for rocks. I don't know if you found rocks. I saw him pick up like sections of branches and throw them at people. I witnessed members of the alt-right going down, you know, sallying down into the street and beating people and getting in fist fights and hitting people with sticks. So they were certainly violent. But again and again, we had not just pepper spray, but tear gas canisters actually lobbed into the park by protesters. I don't know what group that they were a part of. And there was this sort of game. It was almost like a grenade in an old war movie where they would throw something up. They would throw a tear gas canister, and someone would try to jump on it and throw it back into the crowd. And there were a few times when these canisters went back and forth like three or four times before it was too much for anyone to approach it. I personally got gassed or various things, I think five times throughout the day. And that what it was, I don't think I've ever had, I probably never will have another experience quite like that. And then I do want to say, in spite of, I think there were serious mistakes the police made in terms of, I didn't see them. There were no AMTs helping these people that were injured. There were no police officers making arrests while I'm watching people being attacked. That said, I think they made the right call this time when they declared it an unlawful gathering. It fit all of the criteria. This was a riot. Lots of people were getting hurt when they called it. And I also think that the way that they cleared the park was rational and fair. They moved very slowly. It's not like they started marching down and making arrests, you know, because people weren't clearing out. That wouldn't have been right.
That's when all those guys broke up into squads and went throughout the city.
That's right. And so I stayed in the park, and I didn't. And I have heard stories. I've been collecting stories and recording interviews with people who were part of those other fights as things went. I stayed, and knowing that we had other reporters on the team who had already left the park and were following that stuff, I stayed in the park until I think I stopped recording at almost exactly noon.
Yeah, Rick. Your thoughts.
Not to be obsequious because Jack is here, but I think a high level of praise is due the news media, especially our local journalists here, who did an amazing job in chaotic conditions. And I'd single out two photos in particular. There was the one by Andrew Shirtleff of the Daily Progress of the Tiki Torch Parade at UVA. It's the picture that launched 1,000 memes across the world. And secondly, what I think is definitely a Pulitzer Prize-winning photo by Ryan Kelly of the Daily Progress of the exact moment of impact when the car hit
when you see people up in the air.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
I mean, that is photojournalism at its best.
Wow.
And that was on the front page of basically every newspaper in the world.
I gotta go look for it.
Yeah, he's leaving the newspaper.
Oh, that's right. They're hiring. Yeah,
it was his. Well, it turned out not to be his last day because he went back on Sunday to cover the Jason Kessler press conference. But yeah, he's taking a job outside of journalism, but it was basically his last day, and he clearly deserves.
Rick, I want to ask you this question, and again, I don't want to stay down in the weeds of exactly of punches thrown, but Sean's point, which is one of the takeaways from this weekend, is that these two sides in America are done talking. That you've been in politics for a long time, from reporting on it, organizing, running for office, working with people running for office. What's your take on that observation?
I think Sean is right that these two sides aren't talking to each other, and there's not a lot they can find common ground on, but 90% of the people in this country are in the middle between those two sides. And I think we may have seen a turning point when members of the U.S. Senate and Congress started criticizing the president for his mealy-mouthed response to the events.
Do you think it was appropriate that people like Mike Signer so quickly brought Donald Trump in as context for this? For these events, that his political style and how he ran his campaign Bannon and all of that sort of emboldened these crazies.
I think some of our local and state political leaders misbehaved in a sense. I mean, I'll give you an example. Wes Bellamy, vice mayor, he gets invited onto NPR's All Things Considered on Saturday. first thing he says when he's introduced is, please call me doctor. I just received my doctorate yesterday, which is so totally inappropriate.
Yeah.
And
sounds like Wes, though.
Yeah. And, you know, and I think laying blame at, you know, for people who were not present rather than those who actually committed the acts of violence, I think that's a mistake. The only thing I'm glad of is maybe Sean saw something different, but I did not see any fundraising emails go out with Charlottesville in the subject line. Not yet.
They will be happening.
But I really think that Trump's ham-handedness and the response from people like Marco Rubio and Orrin Hatch and Cory Gardner and Tom Garrett and others,
Lindsey Graham.
Lindsey Graham shows that Congress has finally come to the point where Donald Trump is something up with which they will not put. The president showed cowardice, and Congress is finally coming to the point where we're going to go ahead without him. And I'm hoping that this is a turning point where Trump becomes the non-entity in Washington, and Congress takes control.
And you don't see that happening, Sean?
No, I don't. I mean, this is a man that could drive a car down Water Street, and nobody would blame him.
Ouch.
Zing. Yeah. I mean, no, this is going to bounce off of him like Teflon. I mean, again, so this is where Jackson mentioned that, like, the narrative on the right. It's like, well, how is the media responding to this? And what you're seeing from the right and from those and from the alt-light, which are effectively the enablers of the alt-right, you're seeing them sort of try to put shove off against the alt-right, saying, "Oh, no, they were useful for a time, but we're not them, right? Those are bad people, and they just pick up rocks and start throwing them." I mean, you know, Tom Garrett's case in point, man took pictures with Jason Kessler, had his chief of staff invite him down to the UVA town hall.
Yeah.
Now all of a sudden, Kessler's not useful to him, and so he pushes off. Those pictures are going to haunt him for the rest of his political career, and they ought to. There was absolutely, I mean, everybody knew who Kessler was by that point. There was no reason to put an arm around that man. But this is what's actively happening, is that they're pointing back to Antifa, and they're saying, well, look at these people with these communist flags. They're carrying Soviet flags. It's the solidarity, you know, sign with the left hand and the fist in the air. I mean, it looks like any kind of film where, the masses are marching down the street and, the communist revolution is on. They're pointing back at them and saying, well, those are the ones that threw the rocks at the car. And then the car panicked and then went into the crowd. And they're making excuses.
Wait, threw rocks? What rocks?
So apparently
I was on the scene within 10 minutes.
And this is the
people.
Spin when we talk about the spin and the narrative.
I didn't hear anything. This is the first I've. I mean, I was there, and this is the first I've heard about.
So
rocks.
As a matter of fact, ACLU Virginia actually reported and reported the police also corroborated the story that this Dodge Challenger had rocks thrown at it, and that it panicked and turned down the wrong street and just ran into 20 people. Now, ACLU Virginia retracted this later, saying that it's not our place to have said that. We're just kind of reporting. We're not reporters. We're just observing, whatever the case would be. But this is what the alt-right is effectively hanging their hat on. They're saying, well, this guy had rocks thrown at him. And you can see that the car's pretty well beaten up, not from running into people at this point.
I can tell you what I heard on the scene.
Go for it, because that would be immensely helpful to clear up the noise.
So when I got there within 10 minutes, I interviewed a few people. I may have this on video. One gentleman, he told me that, the car was stopped and that people had recognized the guy in there. Somebody recognized him as an alt-right guy from the rally and that people were banging on the car.
Okay.
That was what I heard 10 minutes after the crash. Two different people told me banging on the car, and then somebody else didn't mention banging on the car, but that doesn't mean that it didn't happen. I never heard anything about rocks at the time.
Yeah, I don't think there would be any rocks there available.
In fact, there aren't. I walk down that street every day. I know every inch of it. I have a friend who's an artist who likes to go in that little alley there and draw his Pananimal street art. And so I know I walk down that street every day. There aren't rocks. You're right, Rick. There's not rocks sitting around there.
It's a heck of a speed bump, though.
Yeah.
I don't know how he got away that so fast.
And just taking off of what Sean said about the enablers on the right or alt-right, immediately after Fields drove his car into the crowd, their news, quote-unquote news sites, fake news sites, reporting that he was funded by George Soros and he was a Hillary Clinton supporter. Yeah, yeah. Oh, maybe Sean knows more.
Yeah, it was actually so the VIN number on the car is actually to somebody's son, right? Or you know, it was somebody's father. As a matter of fact, the father happens to be an ardent Bernie supporter. This individual's son sold the car to the Nazi, and the guy is a legitimate neo-Nazi. It was not alleged. I mean, you can go to his Facebook page. There's neo-Nazi.
He's got Hitler hair. I mean, literally.
Sure.
I was at the arraignment this morning and saw, on the video arraignment, and he's got his hair combed like Adolf Hitler.
Yeah, Nuremberg 2.0, I guess. Yeah. So the guy sold his car to that one, and then I guess nobody did the registration or whatever. Well, instantly, and it's still out there. People that are trying to try and find excuses for this are saying that the car was it's a black flag operation, which if you're an Alex Jones fan, you know exactly what that means. It means the government did it.
Yeah.
Turns the frogs gay. So Pepe the Frog decided just to go ahead and run down the road, and that's is what it is. So they're calling it a black flag operation. That rumor's still out there, and they're pointing back to the VIN number and all that nonsense. And you get all the way down to the article, and it's just a little update. It's like, oh, really? It was this guy who did this, blah blah blah. But still, there are all these communist paraphernalia, and we should blame the communists. But that's it. I mean, they're literally peddling the story that it was a black flag and that it was really a Soros-funded operation.
I have family members sending me links to these stories. And I just keep writing back, where are you finding these websites?
Those websites are finding them.
Yeah.
That's what's happening. Those websites are finding them.
I say I love you, but these aren't news sites. Yeah. They're just, who knows what this is? Oh, my gosh, look at this. This is the,
NBC4.com.news.
Right. It's just amazing. It's the Monday Roundtable, and we're discussing the tragic events here in Charlottesville. The phone line is open if you'd like to join this conversation, share your thoughts, any questions at 284-9470. Again,
you better give the area code since there are people listening outside the area.
434 is the area code, 434-284-9470, 284-9470. If you would like to join this conversation. So what happens next? I mean, now, today they're saying, the alt-right's saying that we've got 9 new cities, we've got events planned, we're going to rally. This clearly works. We want unrest in the streets. We want violence in the streets. This is what the alt-right has always wanted. We want violence, destruction, Bannon. This is what Bannon is all about.
I think that'll kill their movement.
No, Bannon wants to burn it all down.
No. This weekend was the grand opening and the expansion. I mean, you just had 600 people blooded in the streets of Charlottesville, thanks to Antifa. I mean, when they're throwing things full of pee and whatnot, when they're throwing rocks and things like that. I mean, people who previously were not radicalized are now radicalized, and they get to go back and spread the good word somewhere else. I mean, this is the same thing. It's like every political opposition builds a simulacrum of what they think the opposition really is. This is what they think Antifa is. This is what they think the political left has been over the last 40 years. They're going to imitate it. Mm-hmm. And that's all this is. So, no, I don't think that this is their high watermark.
Yeah. Let's go to the phone. Caller, you're with us, and you're on the air. You go right ahead.
Hey, guys. I appreciate you taking the call. They got exactly what they wanted. I mean, they consider this to be a massive victory because they got the fight that they wanted. And I just wish people had listened to you. I wish people had done what Rick had done. I wish people had done what they didn't want, which was to not show up and have them be met by crickets. But they wanted this, they got it, and now they're going to be back. And I got no words for what I heard from people that were down there. I wasn't going to go. But they saw the same things that you guys saw down there that Jackson saw. People getting beaten and the cops doing nothing. It's inexplicable. I refuse to believe that they did that without being told specifically not to intervene. It goes against their training. I have close friends that train police at the state level. It's inexplicable. The fact that Longo was baffled by it speaks to that. I think had he been chief of police, this would have been completely different. I believe it would have been handled this way. Can't understand why 4th Street wasn't closed. A whole bunch of stuff here just makes absolutely no sense in terms of how that was handled. So, I mean, I don't know. I just wish people hadn't shown up.
Yeah, but that's not to say that the people who were hurt or the tragic death of the woman brought it on themselves.
Of course not.
Of course not.
I'm simply saying, if you listen to the people that organized this, listen to the people that are now crowing today and saying this was a great success, and Matt Heimbach at his press conference saying, you know, I like Charlottesville, I'm going to come back, because they got the fight they wanted. They said online they wanted a war, they got the fight they wanted, and they're just going to, this is the best recruiting they're ever going to get. That picture of them on the front page of the Daily Progress with their torches and their stupid polo shirts.
Yeah.
They're going to use that
they
forever.
They couldn't afford this kind of advertisement.
No, it's all free, all paid for.
Yeah. Hey, thanks for the call, man. Appreciate it.
All right. Thank you very much.
It's 284-9470. 284-9470 is the phone number, and we're experimenting with taking calls on the roundtable. Sean Kenny is here, Rick Sincere, and Jackson Landers as well. And it's a point that we've all been making for weeks. If you go and you know, protest these people, you give them precisely what they want, but then what do you say to the person who says, I can't stay home, I have a moral obligation to be there to stand up against this? And then what do you say to the people today who even today are saying, oh my God, I wish I had been there?
I think the idea of saying don't go is, we can take the call.
Go ahead.
The idea of saying that you know, don't go is actually very good advice. And if everybody didn't go, then sure, it would have been a lose for them. But in practical terms, that's not going to happen. Like, it's a lofty goal. We talked about this last week. It's the idea of saying everyone should just not go. Sure, but it's impractical. It's so much of a non-starter because they won't actually do it. That you know, I certainly don't criticize people for deciding that they're going to go morally. So yeah, your position you'd taken for a long time, Coy, saying please, people just don't go. You're right. But it doesn't matter because people are going to go.
You know, watching the press conference yesterday where Jason Kessler was assaulted by three or four different people and driven out of the downtown mall by a mob, it just told me that the Antifa left does not understand political tactics. You don't turn your enemy into a victim. You know, I watched that and I watched
that.
It
was hilarious watching him. I was there watching him through those bushes like Sean Spicer on acid.
The thing that kept coming to mind was Emperor Palpatine saying to Luke Skywalker, "Come over to the dark side. I mean, give into your anger." And, you know, and that's what they did. I mean, and they fed.
You're right.
They fed their adversaries. They nourished their adversaries.
And this is the strategy of the alt-right, because they know, as far as I'm concerned, they played this town like a concert pianist. They knew how to press the buttons, and I'm going to get you mad, and I'm going to make you throw stuff, and I'm going to make you look exactly like what I tell people you are.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. It's the phone number is 284-9470. Caller, you're on the air. Go right ahead. Hello, 434-284-9470. If you can get through, just hang on, and we will be with you very shortly. It's about 12 minutes in front of 6 o'clock, and you're listening to Inside Charlottesville. We're online at InsideCville.com. So, Sean, how should you, caller, stay with us, we'll be right with you. How should you respond then? I mean, if you are truly, you know, like any one of us sitting here, you don't support fascism. You think this is ridiculous, and these people are nutters. But how do you respond then?
So the
without giving them exactly what they want.
Yeah. So the Ku Klux Klan in the 1920s used to do this in Catholic neighborhoods, right? They'd go down, they'd march down a Catholic neighborhood, they'd say this is ours, and then they'd go home. But immediately the following day, the Knights of Columbus would go out and put on their funny hats, and they'd get their swords and their tuxedos, and they'd march down the very same street. They would literally give them the space to be stupid, and then like 10 times that number would go down the street and march and be happy. And finally, the way it culminated is they got Columbus Day, which was sort of a way of Catholics and Slavs and Italians and Irish saying we have arrived in America and this is our day. I think there's something to learn from that experience, quite honestly. And you know, there's something to profit from that example. I mean, maybe somewhere in the way we've tackled this sentiment in the past, you know, we can tackle it for the future.
Yeah. Caller, you're on the air with us. Thank you for calling. You go right ahead. Well, we keep having problems with the phone. I think we need to get a call screener. That might help.
Just to clarify what Sean was saying is that counter-protesters should counter-protest, but the next day. Yeah. Do not confront, but counter-protest. And I think you can make your same point without anybody getting hurt.
Because if you counter-protest at the same time that dangerous, crazy, armed people are rallying, you're only going to have what we have. But then again, I catch myself because then that sounds like we're blaming the people who were out there. It sounds like we're blaming the woman who was killed.
We're not blaming the woman who was killed, but I think people have a responsibility to be prudent. And if they fail to be prudent, they should face the consequences of their actions.
So what do you say to people, though, that, no way, Rick, you have to stand up for these people? I understand what you're saying. It's like Jackson says to me, Corey, you're right, but who cares? Ultimately, people aren't going to give them the crickets they deserve.
It's like
the journalists aren't going to turn their cameras the other way.
You have a problem with weight loss, or people being overweight. It's easy to say, look, just stop eating so much, and the problem will be fine. Well, that's true, but...
The problem is you eat too much.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Caller, go ahead. Thanks for your call. Go right ahead.
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air. Go right ahead. Thanks for being with us.
I feel like everyone needs to speak out against this. Maybe not actually confront these Nazis or whatever, but they were so provoking. Even Cornel West said he felt like taking a swing at him, but he didn't. They provoked. They came to our town and were promoting violence, bringing weapons. They need to be run out of town. They can't come here and feel like it's okay for them to be here. They should be let known this is unacceptable, like the governor said. This is not acceptable. If people accept it and allow them to march around like it's normal, then it just keeps going on.
But how do you run them out of town without giving them the violence in the streets that fulfills their vision? That is the vision of the alt-right, is a social unrest, violence in the streets, the decay of normal society.
I don't think hate groups should be allowed to march.
So you would have not given them the permit in the first place, because the speech that they advocate is violence and hatred.
Yeah, I mean, they just should not be allowed to march. No hate group like KKK, white supremacists, they should be nowhere allowed to march. They should not be allowed to march. These statues should all be removed. These are traitors, treasonous. If it was up to Robert E. Lee, we would be having some other kind of whatever. We wouldn't have democracy. We'd have some kind of slave trade, whatever the South was. I don't know.
Yeah.
We'd be living in a whole different universe.
Thanks for your call, man. I appreciate it. Let's get the panelists to respond to your thoughts. The number is lines open, 284-9470, area code 434. If you get through, just hang on, and I'll be with you as soon as we can get to you, 284-9470.
So one of the things that they kind of like turn back to is that the antidote for bad speech is never good speech. It's free speech. And, obviously, there's always the impulse when you see, whether it's, pick your poison, Antifa or the alt-right or, Planned Parenthood or the Dallas Cowboys march down the street, that you want to go ahead and, throw in a Washington Redskins jersey somewhere. The difference is that, you've got, in America at least, we respect each other's opinions, even if they're wrong. And it's that old Voltaire line where it's, I disagree with what you have to say, but I'll defend to the death your right to say it. And to some degree, we have to give these people, the latitude to be stupid in the public square. And then let the public square handle it. But if we try to substitute their bad speech for good speech, we're going to get...
Where do you draw the line?
Yeah. You don't. That's why it's free.
So what about the one of the points that Siva Vaidyanathan made in his op-ed in the New York Times is, you can't have free speech if the people who are speaking are armed. That is very intimidating, direct show of force while someone is speaking. You can't have a conversation in the public square if somebody's out there brandishing a gun while they're speaking.
Well, but the alt-right weren't brandishing guns.
The
militia that was with them, that is not part of them, I didn't see anyone with a firearm.
But you know what? Until this moment, I didn't know they were not part of them. I mean, and you knew that, but I thought they were out there with them.
I think one of the most amazing things about this weekend that there was no gunfire anywhere.
True.
Yeah, which would support your point that you can't have free speech with the guns. Yeah, because nobody killed anybody with a gun. Caller, you're on the air. You go right ahead. Thanks for your call.
I believe that these groups, and I avoided the whole confrontation as much as I'd like to hit a Nazi, these people are probably 99% of them probably wouldn't pass some sort of psychological test to prove they're sane. And so I felt it would be unfair to go and engage in a fight, which is obviously what was going to happen, with a sick person with guns and, you know, looking for a fight. So that was my approach to it. I avoided the area completely.
Yeah. Did you know people who went down?
Pardon me?
Did you know folks who went down there?
I can't understand you. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Did you know folks who went downtown to protest, who were part of it?
I went to the KKK thing. I was at the park early and saw what was brewing then, and it smelled way worse than that.
It was.
before this one, so I just left town.
Yeah. Yeah. There you go. Thanks for your call. I appreciate it.
My observation, having been in close contact with each other, and also having covered a lot of I'm not as much of an expert on the alt-right nationally as Sean certainly is, but my interactions with these people, yes, some of them are crazy and would probably be considered mentally ill, but I don't think most of them. They believe things that I don't believe.
I saw a bunch of them walking down the street, I'm like, these are the guys that used to go to the Renaissance fairs, you know, with their swords and their shields. I mean, it looks exactly nothing against Renaissance fairs, but these are the guys that play Dungeons and Dragons. I mean, it's just
I know people like I see what you're getting at. I do not think there's. I'm not sure that there. Let's not say that there's crossover, because people who do play Dungeons and Dragons have
Jackson
been,
plays Dungeons and Dragons.
I don't. I never have.
Jackson's a nerd.
I never have, but they were discriminated against, and people were kicked out of schools and stuff and called Satanists. So I want to be careful what we say about these people.
Yeah, that's very fair.
And it looked like a frat party. I mean, like toga. I mean, they had some of the tiki torches, but that's all it really was.
Yeah. There's a bro factor.
Yeah, it's 4chan culture.
Oh, there absolutely is, that's an important angle on it.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah, just a bunch of bros that are sexually frustrated that can't get dates, and so they got to go march down the wrong way.
We literally only have a couple of minutes left, but that does sort of point to one of the other things we've talked about on this program before, is that, the young bros in Yemen or Iraq, they're falling prey to the same ideology. Hey, man, your identity, culture, everything you believe in, everything that you support, that you think is all about you as a man, is under threat. And you better grab a weapon of some kind and jump in this Jeep with all these other guys and go look for a fight to defend it. I mean, they're defending, their Muslim identity in Yemen, just like the white guy is in Lee Park defending what he thinks is his white culture.
And you get to feel like you belong to something. You get that the camaraderie, which maybe is missing in people's lives sometimes. And you get to feel like you get into a fight and you feel like you're fighting for good. And it feels good.
Yeah, I mean, and the next comment comes from the anthropologist, who says, you're 100% right. I mean, this really speaks to something, really, really deep down and tribal, which, as Sean brings us full circle to one of your original comments today, that these tribes are, these tribes don't want to speak anymore.
Well,
they just want to fight.
The other thing is that they claim to be standing up for American values and for their rights, but when you pursue the line of questioning, so what are American values? What are our rights under the Constitution? They don't have a clue. I mean, they couldn't pass a citizenship test if somebody was whispering the answers into their ear.
Yeah, and I think it's an important point, and we've made it many Mondays all summer long. This alt-right is very anti-American. It's absolutely diametrically opposed to the fundamental ideals that have animated this country since the very beginning. They don't like this. They don't like free press. They don't like elective government, democracy,
yeah. Multiculturalism.
Yeah. Absolutely
free press, free speech.
Not.
Yeah.
Public schools. No. Yeah. No. They like Putin.
Yeah.
I mean, and their hope was that Trump would be that guy, but yeah. I think he's disappointed them.
Indeed, which tells you how far right they really are.
Yeah. Sean Kenny, Rick Sincere, Jackson Landers, you can find them online. Thank you guys so much. It's the Monday Roundtable. You can find this podcast online as soon as I can get it up there at InsideSeaville.com. Y'all have a terrific week, and be good to each other.